Hi, this is Cecily Armstrong. Thank you for listening to this week's show on your favorite podcast platform. You can go to our website, grapesgrainscrub.com, for pictures, stories, recipes, music, and extras about this episode and other episodes, delicious travel ideas, my culinary picks, and a lot more. Okay, so let's get started. I hope you enjoy this week's episode. You're listening to Grapes, Grains, and Grub, where we believe agriculture tastes good, and I'm your host, Cecily Armstrong. Today, my special guest is chef and restaurateur David Guas of Washington, D.C., by way of New Orleans. His Southern and Cuban cultural roots present themselves in every bite and experience at his Bayou Bakery Coffee Bar and Eatery in Washington, D.C. You know him from his frequent TV appearances, including as a recurring judge on Food Network's Chopped. Boy, people love that show. And his award-winning cookbooks and good works with so many organizations, I'd have to take the whole show to tell you. So you can find his bio on our website. And today, I ask him about his Southern ways, fatherhood, making grits and cornbread ground from corn on George Washington's grist mill. Yeah, we've got pictures of that too. And him riding Harleys and so much more.
You know, we fly all of our bacon in from Madisonville, Tennessee, you know, every Monday, 150 pounds. And, you know, we get our, you know, all of our hams come from down in Surrey, Virginia, Sam Edwards and their whole family that going on for over 100 years. And, you know, our peanuts come from Belmont Farms down in Southampton, Virginia. And so, you know, our pecans are coming from Georgia, Pearson Family Farms.
Later in the show, we reveal this episode's culinary destination and my picks this week, including a craft beer that people are going crazy about and a couple of other items that I am really loving right now. But before we get to my conversation with Chef David Guas, here's our weekly front of house segment with entertaining and hospitality expert Robert Rodriguez sharing his professional inside scoop and tips about the importance of music during your next dinner or event. Taking us from front of house to your house on every episode of Grapes, Grains, and Grub. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
And here today, I have you in the studio to talk about cha-cha-cha music. I love front of house segment. This is one of my favorite things. And we're tackling the gigantic subject of music today. And you just said to me that having this triangle of music, lighting, and seating and how important that is. So let's talk about the music part of it.
Music is hugely important. It really communicates non-verbally. It's nothing you have to do or spend a lot of money on. You just have to think about it in advance, but it communicates the style of event and really gives you an opportunity to connect with the guest on another level. So whether that's live music or pre-recorded, or it's something that you customize on one of your services for an event at your house, it's something that can be very special and memorable for a guest. Consider how the music tempo affects the mood. In a professional setting, the tone and the tempo makes all the difference. We change volume levels throughout the day. It's a little louder for brighter, lighter times of day, you know, tying that in with the lighting. It's like, is it brunch? Is it lunch? Is it quick service that people have to get back to their offices? Let's turn up the music a little bit and make it a little more lively in here. Or happy hour, especially. It's a party at the bar. So we're going to turn that up and make it a little bit more lively. So we definitely look at what's going on and determine what the music levels are based on that. Consider the source of the music. Music is one of those things that you can plan for year-round because you can build your playlists, you can put new songs on, take old songs off, and really have that working constantly. So if you know you have a 2 or 3 hour event, you can build a playlist throughout the year to really accommodate what you want to happen, whether you want it to start out nice and loud and then get a little mellow and then end with a bang, or if you want it to end mellow, you know, if you want it to start loud and then work down from there, you know, it's all in your control and you have time, you know, even throughout the year. Lots of time to figure out how you want that event to flow. You can also customize your music list to really amplify what your theme is for that night, whether or not it's a themed night. You know, maybe it's just friends getting together, but you know, if you know them well enough, you know what music they respond to and put that on there. You know, if it's an Oscar party, put some movie music in there, you know, put your favorites in there, put some of the new nominees in there, things like that. Have fun with it so that people can identify it and really remember that. Don't forget to consider the volume of the music. Also, when planning events at home, you know, consider your guests, consider the different areas of your home, because some people want to be close to the music and have a good time, and they want something with a beat, and they want something that, you know, that's fun. Some people want to be a little further away from that, and or have a different, you know, sound available, you know, outside or in a different room with comfy seating. So that way, there's a space for everybody to be comfortable, and you can do different types of music in different areas, even in your home. And along with the volume of music, always, and you can do this at home when you're planning, you know, even if you're doing your own playlist, but, you know, if you're dealing with live music or a musician, do a sound check to make sure that volume levels are where you need them to be. Because sometimes you want a very lively space. You want people to yell at each other to communicate. If you don't want that, then you need to make sure that your sound levels are much lower than that. So a sound check is always recommended.
Robert, those were amazing tips. Thank you so much. Music, oh my gosh, it's so incredibly important to all of our experiences and your knowledge, whether it be from restaurants, hotels, fine dining, your own soirees, and fun family events. Thank you, Robert Rodriguez.
Thank you very much. Time to get back to work.
Today, I'm catching up with my pal, David Guas. From New Orleans to Washington, D.C., he is the chef and owner of Bayou Bakery Coffee Bar and Eatery, of course, an award-winning cookbook author and motorcycle riding TV star. Not bad. So, David, I'm so thrilled to have you on the show today because Grapes, Grains, and Grub, as our listeners know, really is true to agriculture tastes good. And you know that so inherently well that not only are you entertaining, you really are quite an expert.
Well, I mean, I know what I know.
You know, first, I really want to tell our listeners about Bayou Bakery and what you're doing now. I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah. Well, we opened in November of 2010 and created a very casual space, open 7 to 7, 7 days a week. And, you know, I kind of just started adding things and layers to the menu that made sense for, you know, tell my story and represent the state of Louisiana as best we could. And, you know, kind of the overall general Deep South as well. And the idea was that, you know, mom and dad could come in with the kids. They could make a mess with powdered sugar and beignets, and mom could get a glass of wine and dad could get a beer or vice versa or whatever. And so here we are years later, and we're still kicking butt in the suburb here of Arlington, Virginia, just a mile from D.C., and it's been a fun ride so far.
So you've brought New Orleans to D.C. by way of Cuba?
Yeah, loosely, yeah, for sure. Growing up in New Orleans, you know, born and raised in the great city of New Orleans, and then left the Windsor Court Hotel in 98 to move to D.C. to help a local restaurant group open their first restaurant. And then I was with those guys for 10 years, Passion Food Hospitality. And yes, my father was born and raised in Havana till the age of 12. And then he had a Louisiana mother and a Cuban father. And so during the revolution, they brought all the kids back, himself and his brother. And he went to boarding school at St. Stanislaus in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. And that's kind of his first introduction to the United States, was right into the good old boarding school at St. Stanislaus. And so, you know, we were raised with Cuban food and Louisiana food growing up on our table. And so my dad did a great job to attempt to inject as much of the Cuban aspect as he could, along with my grandmother when she was still alive would do the same. So
that's so interesting, and such incredible layers to that story. And that really comes out in your food. I mean, you know, it's so interesting to trying to find, and, you know, the Southern Foodways Alliance and other organizations mm-hmm. do such a wonderful job that I know you're a member of. But
yes,
like if you had to say an elevator pitch, right, to somebody in Hollywood as to what is Southern food, I mean, is that even possible?
Well, let me say this. Like, I narrow New Orleans down specifically and done lectures over the years on, you know, culturally what it kind of looks like from the outside, as opposed to, you know, what people label New Orleans, because New Orleans is about as tricky as it gets to kind of to put a, you know, a stamp on it and say it's this. You know, we kind of always identify ourselves as New Orleanians as kind of being like a whole nother country,
right?
Not just the state of Louisiana, but specifically the city being like no other city in the world. And, you know, from a culinary standpoint, as far as the influx of resources and products and, you know, over the past 300 years being a major port city, you know, I often describe it as more Northern Caribbean than it is Deep South.
Oh, interesting.
Just with how common rice is with every dish, you know, and, you know, the okras and the tomatoes and the other sort of ingredients that have become part of Louisiana as a whole and New Orleans specifically. That's one of those cultures that we're often talking about lunch during breakfast and talking about what we're going to cook for dinner while we're, you know, choking down a po' boy. So,
right.
You know, I think like anything as a kid growing up in any city, you know, you take for granted where you're from. And then, you know, once you mature and get a little older, and especially for me falling into this industry, you know, you really realize how special of a place it is. And I think that, you know, for me, having been away now for 21 years, we do a lot of work with Louisiana here on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, and, you know, from the oystermen coming up here and lobbying and, you know, our American Wild Caught Shrimp Association and, you know, everything that we're trying to do, Louisiana Seafood Association and all these big groups that are, you know, trying to continue to grab money and bring it back to the state so we can continue to have the resources we have and pull from the bounty that we have in that awesome state.
It really is a bounty. I mean, part of what we love to talk about on this show and our listeners love is the stories behind the agriculture. When you're raising a fork and taking a bite, first and foremost, you know, you want it to taste good and be satisfied and all of that good stuff, have an emotional connection. But really, if you think about what it took to get that oyster onto that table and all the hands that touch that rice that's on your plate and the origins of so many different types of rice that come from all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, I joke about bread and rice being such a part of the New Orleans, you know, dinner table and lunch table and breakfast table. And, you know, now that a lot of the sugar cane has depleted over the years with, you know, overdevelopment and cities growing. And, you know, 20 years ago, Lafayette looked a lot different than it does now. And so, you know, cane is difficult and hard on the environment. And, you know, it's not an easy thing to grow. And so I think, you know, from a yield standpoint, we've seen a lot of changes in our cane harvest and productivity in the U.S. in general, but specifically in Louisiana. And so, you know, when you can double up and be a crawfish farmer and a rice farmer at the same time, I think that's kind of the best of both worlds. And that's what we see a lot of down in that Vermilion Parish region, Lafayette and Abbeville and Crowley and, you know, New Iberia and in that whole region.
Is that something where organizations have come in and said, we're going to train you to a rice farmer how to raise crawfish? Or is that something that is just a learned practice because of the geographic nature and the culture of what's there?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that, you know, from a generation standpoint, generationally, families have, you know, kind of brought up the next generation to kind of continue doing what they're doing. And, you know, with the innovations we've had, obviously, the newer generation is bringing more drastic changes and more efficient practices, you know, less footprint on the environment, but yet, you know, better yields. And overall, I think farmers are definitely smarter than they ever have been. I think, you know, Louisianians, obviously, I'm a little partial to this comment and maybe a little biased, but, you know, they've always been innovators and the ingenuity has always been there, going all the way back to when the Cajuns actually ended up traveling and staking land and they're sort of, you know, claiming their properties and their territory after being exiled from numerous places and ended up down there. And you know, they had to live off the land and figure it out. And this is a product of all of that and being survivors. And I think that, you know, with, you know, LSU, the Louisiana State University and all their agricultural programs, you know, amazing. The university puts out so many different research, you know, programs and invests a lot of time and funds and energy and have great curriculums at the university based on just that, you know, what Louisiana is known for from an agricultural standpoint, the rice program that's spawned from the state of Louisiana, different varietals they've learned about and tested. And so I think that, you know, the partnership more than just, you know, LSU, you know, even in Thibodeau at Nichols and things like that, you know, they're always sort of reinvesting back into the area that they're in, whether it's, you know, wetland erosion or farming practices or what have you.
I think it's exciting. And I think there's, you know, such growing opportunities and a shifting mindset that agribusiness is something that I think has not always been, the people that are in it obviously are in it, but that hasn't necessarily been something in the consciousness of, you know, the public of, you know, what that really takes.
Yeah, adapting, learning new techniques and overcoming and coming out on top and shifting gears has always been, sort of the skill set and a required resume, for farmers. Our issues with climate change and everything else that's going on. And, if you don't subscribe to the fact that we've got environmental issues shifting with our climate, you just go hang out for a couple of weeks with farmers from today versus, 20 years ago versus 40 years ago, and they can tell you firsthand the effects.
Sage advice. Well, it's interesting because your background, and I know it's how these things develop in life, and you get to a certain point and you look back and you say, wow, how did I accumulate that skill and that knowledge, and why did I step into that arena being a chef and restaurateur? But you're so knowledgeable on agribusiness and organizations and sort of moving the needle forward on certain things. Was that a conscious decision that you made being in the culinary industry, or did it just happen because of your passion?
I think it is sort of a gradual process. The desire to learn more about the ingredients that you're physically checking in on a dolly that comes through your restaurant. What we've done here at Bayou Bakery over the last 8.5-9 years is and this is really just a selfish thing. It's, the byproduct of my relationships with farmers is that I get a phenomenal product.
Right.
The main motivation and drive for seeking certain, vendors and farmers and artisans bringing their product into my restaurant solely was based on relationships. Initially, obviously, I wouldn't engage, in a relationship with someone who, didn't have a quality product. But, we fly all of our bacon in from Madisonville, Tennessee, every Monday, 150 pounds. And, we get our, all of our hams come from down in Surrey, Virginia, and Sam Edwards and their whole family that going on for over 100 years. And, our peanuts come from Belmont Farms down in Southampton, Virginia. And so, our pecans are coming from Georgia, Pearson Family Farms. So I think, I can't get every single product from, the artisans, but I get a handful of probably about 8 to 10 that I deal with from all over the country that are kind of, in my opinion, the best at what they do.
Gosh, David, that's a lot of work, but it really is about the quality, and you really put the effort in. So let's talk about the corn that comes off of George Washington's grist mill. I mean, my gosh, you guys have been working with them a long time to make your delicious items in the restaurant.
The distillery and the mill are on about 7 acres, just 3 miles away from the main estate in Mount Vernon. And, we've got a long-term relationship now with the master miller out there, and they do our yellow corn meal and our white corn grits for us. And Steve Bashore is the master miller and has kind of shifted gears a little bit and oversees both the distillery and the mill. Every weekend we make our grits, and then throughout the week, we use the yellow meal for cookies and cornbread and things of that nature. So yeah, we're always trying to think about how we put it in front of people again,
And you're really tasting a piece of history if you think about it.
Definitely.
So Bayou Bakery is sounding a little bit more like an embassy of American products.
Yeah, I mean, we try to represent the vendors as much as we can, and educating our general public. And there's always going to be a percentage of people that, just say, all I want is a muffalata. I don't need to know where the olives came from. But we do it for selfish reasons, for me. It's my place. It's like my house. It's my everything. And, it's a team effort, of course. I never take all the credit for what happens behind these doors. But as far as, being the showman and being proud of what we're attempting to do, there's always issues with, execution and little daily operation issues that we try to overcome.
But, of course,
as far as starting at the top and starting with quality, I invite anybody to argue, that with me as far as what we do here. So, we try to remind our team, that we are special and unique, and we're not your average counter service operation. And, because of these things and these relationships that I have with people and what I believe in their, their products, and I'm proud to part with a lot of these guys.
That's really wonderful. And at the end of the day, the proof is in the pudding. And, everybody knows that your food is good food. So let's talk about your television career and really participating in types of competition kind of shows and those things. Being so well informed, do you feel as a judge it gives you a different insight? And you'll let our listeners know, when you're on Chopped or Chop Junior or other shows that you do, do you have a different viewpoint sometime than your co-judges because you are so knowledgeable about agribusiness and quality products?
I think, you know, speaking specifically of the Food Network and my few appearances on Chopped as a judge, I think, like you mentioned, both, you know, Junior and regular Chop, you know, I think that a lot of times, you know, they'll call me up based on what they already know about me and kind of what I stand for and represent, whether it's, you know, Louisiana, New Orleans, Southern cuisine, Cuban cuisine, what have you. I think that, you know, that's the beauty of having three judges is that you have a couple house judges that have their, you know, opinions and they're pretty consistent with their judgments and their critiques and their feedback. And then you have a lone wolf coming in that's, you know, considered a expert on a particular topic, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Their words, not mine, expert. But, you know, so, you know, I've done a Cuban episode on Chopped and, you know, a lot of pride around that. And, you know, to see all the different contestants, you know, represent with such a prideful sort of energy around, you know, the Cuban cuisine.
That must have been great fun for you.
Oh, it was a blast. Absolute blast.
I want you to shed some light and information on coffee for our coffee-loving listeners. So I know that Bayou Bakery Coffee Bar and Eatery is known for coffee.
We've partnered with Counterculture, which is our lead and main roaster out of Durham, North Carolina. And we've been with them since we unlocked the doors. I love, you know, now, you know, in the last 10 years, there's been so much growth, you know, and I can only really speak for the D.C. area around coffee. You know, the game has definitely stepped up. A lot of the big boys from outside of the state have come in, you know, and set up shop here and got some local success stories of local roasters doing amazing things. And, you know, for us, starting with Counterculture, the support they provide, we have access to their training facilities and labs where we can send our baristas to continue their education. They will help our baristas get certified if that's, you know, something that they desire in the world of coffee. But for the most part, our main goal is just to get them, you know, familiar with coffee enough that they can learn the ins and outs, they can create a quality product and kind of love what they do when they're at work.
Right, right.
We've had a handful of people that have kind of gone on to compete and do other things. And, but, you know, we were always kind of representing, again, you know, New Orleans, and we do one of our most popular beverages, our Nola iced coffee. And
yum.
It's, we just call it Ice Nola, and it's a chicory blend that we do ourselves. We match up a roast from Counterculture, and then we blend roasted ground chicory into that blend of coffee, and then we'll flash brew kind of ice style flash brew ice coffee where we scale it, brew it over ice, and then we'll hit it with a little simple syrup, and then a la minute, we finish it with, once it's poured into the glass, we'll finish it on top a little bit of half and half, and the half and half gives it just that kind of round fattiness that kind of helps cut some of the bitterness of the chicory. And of course, a little bit of the simple syrup helps to kind of bring some of that harshness out a little bit, but still makes it, you know, doesn't mask it entirely. And it creates kind of this really unique kind of rich, smoky iced coffee. It's delicious.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm just sitting here. Listeners, I don't know if I told you that I'm in our studios in San Antonio today. And I'm thinking, how fast can I get to Virginia for one of those Nola iced coffee? That sounds incredible. So let's explain to our listeners about chicory, because not everybody knows what that is.
Well, chicory is a member of the endive family, and, you know, the root itself is what's used to kind of roast and grind and dry and kind of almost treat it like coffee in the process of how it's kind of roasted and dried out and ground. But, you know, this was something that was introduced to the city of New Orleans, you know, hundreds of years ago. And that was, you know, again, being a major port city and having unique products come from all over the world,
right,
through New Orleans. Definitely New Orleans, I think, was the first city that actually brought coffee into the U.S., along with bananas and a handful of other products that made their U.S. debut through New Orleans. And it's prevalent throughout the city, you know, the menu and the culture, you know, to kind of celebrate how, you know, much of a coffee city New Orleans really is.
Right.
And, you know, the chicory was brought in to kind of create and stretch out the coffee because coffee was more expensive. And so basically during Depression era and whatnot, and just, you know, when times were tough, it was easier to kind of steep in this ground roasted chicory and kind of stretch out the coffee. So, you know, the percentage of chicory to coffee was a lot higher back in the day. So imagine drinking a cup of black bitterness. You know, it definitely was an acquired taste, but culturally, you know, caught on. And now the city kind of celebrates, you know, that aspect of the coffee preparation. And, you know, for me, I, you know, as a kid, it was not something I drank growing up, but a chicory, you know, cafe au lait, you know, done tableside in the right place is a pretty special thing these days for me. So I do enjoy it. I think the older I get, just like my coffee and my chocolate and everything else, I like things a little bit more on the bitter end than the heavier, sweeter end.
Isn't that interesting? I think that particularly too with all of your baked goods and everything that you bake that you incorporate into your whole menu, the savory side of baking is something that you guys really are known for as well.
Exactly. Always doing things with, you know, rendered pork fat or bacon specifically, or, you know, sharp cheeses and herbs and whatnot. So we're not always kind of thinking about sugar and Steen's cane syrup and honey and things like that. So we try to kind of have a nice blend of all of it.
Well, you know, I just need to get up there.
Yes.
I'm starving now.
We're waiting for
you. I know. It sounds, you know, it really is such a beautiful part of our country. And when you think beyond the government, right? When you think beyond that, and what an beautiful and interesting part of the United States that you're in up there. A lot of our listeners really enjoy kind of rural living and really being outdoors. And so let's just talk about you on a Harley. Now, I know you're a hunter.
I am.
Awesome. And do you, you know, take your Harley with you?
Not when I hunt.
Do you have a toy trailer that you like hide it in and pull behind, or?
No, I don't have a trailer. I never trailer it. If I'm going to go somewhere, I ride it from point A to point B and back. And we have a group of chefs that we kind of started forming a group together about maybe 12 or 15 years ago. And we've been out to Sturgis, South Dakota in 2006 together. 12 days we took off, and it was 9 of us. And we put on 4,600 miles on the bikes.
Wow.
That trip. And we did it. We raised some money and did a charity thing. And you know, now it's a little bit more, you know, as you get older and busier with life, you know, you don't get those getaways as often as you'd like. But, you know, mine's garage kept and always fired up, and I'm always tinkering with it and having it ready to go. So when the clouds break and I'm, you know, slow at work, or I've got those windows of opportunity, they literally just open up. I could be at work at, you know, noon and say, I'm going to head out and head to the house, grab the bike, and I'm gone for the next 4 to 6 hours just for a quick getaway. Shenandoah is only 50 miles away. So
wow.
Blue Ridge Mountains are literally in my backyard here in DC. A lot of people forget that. They always think of Capitol Hill and the White House and all the business aspect and the politics. But, you know, DC is surrounded by waterways and mountains and everything else. It's amazing. So, you know, and then the hunting side offers me, again, both things are getting me outside. And that's where I thrive. That's where I love. That's closer to my heart, you know, being kind of cooped up in a kitchen is my world. But, you know, outside of that, I've balanced my work life with the things that I enjoy and I love to pass down to my kids, which is, you know, teaching ethical hunting and practices and harvesting whole animals and things of that nature. And, you know, my boys know how to break down geese and ducks since they were about 11 years old and know what to do with them and know 5 different preparations. And, you know, it's always sort of a question, what are we going to do this year that's different as far as making jerky or marinating or sausage or whatever. So that's, you know, of course, I always find myself back in the kitchen with all these type of habits and hobbies. But the bike allows us just to literally get away, put it in the rearview mirror and leave all the crap behind and just get out there and wind in your hair and everything else. Everybody, all the cliches are
right.
All pretty accurate. So, you know, that sense of freedom and, you know, picking bugs out of your teeth. I mean, mm-hmm. I love it. Love everything about it.
The breeze on your knees.
Breeze on your knees, bugs in your teeth, everything.
Right.
Yeah, it's incredible. So,
well, that's great fun. Listen, David, thank you so much for sharing time with us today and doing some great storytelling behind your food and your life and your family. And those things are not mutually exclusive in your world and most people's world. You know, I think that what you're saying is what a lot of people at home think about when they're trying to find the best ingredients. And
of course,
you know, they can. What I would say to listeners is follow chefs like David and others who really have the knowledge and follow them. Look at their menus online. You can go to their, you don't have to be there. You can go online and
sure.
Take a look at their menus and see where they get their ingredients from. And
Exactly.
You know, if we get into that mindset as consumers, when we're out shopping, we may just take an extra 30 seconds and really compare products at the grocery store.
Or read the labels.
Read the labels. Go to a farmer's market.
Exactly.
You know, divert your shopping to a farmer's market, or literally go to a farm. You know,
exactly.
I know that there's you know, hog farmers out there. There's all kinds of places that people don't realize that are right there in their towns, in their regions.
We've got a ton in Maryland and Virginia, so it's amazing in our backyard here. So
yeah. Awesome. Hey, everybody, this has been David Kwas, and we thank him so much for being on the show today. And this won't be the last time that we check in with you from Grapes, Grains, and Grub. Thank you, David.
You bet. I appreciate being on. Thanks so much.
Whether it's a plane, a train, or an automobile, make your way to this culinary destination.
Our culinary destination pick is the Willamette Valley in the Oregon Wine Country. Did you know there are more than 500 wineries to visit? This lush, green, culinary destination is for those who also love the outdoors. Within 150 miles, there are gorgeous vineyards and family farms to visit, and chefs who specialize in cuisine, showcasing Earth's bounty from the land and waterways of the Great Northwest.
And now, here's Cecily's picks.
Okay, so here's three things I'm just so in love with right now. Now, the first one is an oldie but a goodie for me, newfound again. So it's called Boetjes. I'm going to spell it for you. B-O-E-T-J-E, apostrophe S. This is all on the website. So Boetjes, Dutch mustard, stone ground, and wood aged. So I had this as a kid for years, and then we moved and stopped getting it. And hello, it's online. You can buy it online. So I'm just buying it by the case these days. There's nothing else like it out there. It's the way that they make it is amazing. So here's what they do. So it's an old world recipe. They use top ingredients. They have this special grind that they give the mustard seeds. Then they blend it and age it in wood vats. That's the mustard seeds. Then they stone grind them. It releases all the flavors. They put it all together, and that's the mustard. Now, I love the original. They also have a bourbon barrel and a sea sauce. Oh, it's so good. You will have this, and you'll just never want any other mustard again until I have another mustard on another pick. But anyway, Boetjes Dutch mustard, stone ground, and wood aged. Okay, my next one is Sonoma flatbreads. So I'm looking at the box right now, and big time, it says gluten-free. This is the four cheese, but I'm telling you, even if you don't need to be gluten-free, you're going to love this pizza. There's a picture on the back of the woman who is the chairwoman of Sonoma flatbread. So they're just delicious. They're easy to make. And who doesn't want something great from Sonoma in Northern California? So this comes from a family that has been making pizza for over 50 years, and they got frustrated because they couldn't find pizza that was frozen pizza that they wanted. They wanted something that wasn't mass produced. So in 2012, they started this healthier lifestyle, but still traditional pizza. Now they call them flatbreads, but I have to tell you, it's a pizza. I highly recommend them. They are delicious. It is a certified women-owned independent business. A woman called Jane Grote Abel, I hope I'm saying her name right, is the chairwoman. And it is, even the pepperoni is nitrate free. It's certified gluten free, super crispy crust. Pop them in the oven, done really quickly. No artificial flavors or colorings. It's just yummy goodness. Okay, my next pick is okay, UFOs. All right, so it's called UFO Beer, and it's an employee-owned brewery that is in Boston, Massachusetts, and Windsor, Vermont. Everybody's going bonkers for this beer. I mean, my producer, everybody else that I'm talking to is in love with this UFO beer. Now, you can find it around the country. We'll have a link for the website on our site, and you'll be able to find where you can get them. Now, there's different beer flavors in different locations, but it's things like raspberry, UFO white, UFO pineapple, the big squeeze, which is the grapefruit. But it's just super cool, super delicious, and people are talking about it constantly. You guys maybe have heard about it already, but I highly recommend it. And they've got recipes on their site. And of course, their UFO locator. Who doesn't love that? All right, so those are my quick picks right there, off the cuff, but all the information with the pictures, the links, everything you need to know to find out more about these picks of mine are on grapesgrainsgrub.com. Those were some fun picks, if I do say so myself. If you have a product, destination, idea, or location you want us to know about, just go to our site for all the many, many ways to contact us. We really would love to hear your picks, and you know, you might just hear them on the show. I just loved doing the research and interviews for this episode. I always learn something. I hope you do too. You know, I grew up in South Texas, Acapulco, Mexico, and the Texas Hill Country, which is located between San Antonio and Austin. And when I moved to New York City to follow my dream of becoming a writer many, many years ago, it opened up a culinary world where the kind of farm, ranch, and ocean-sourced ingredients I had grown up eating were taken to a whole new level. With so many talented chefs and gastronomists who I've had the great fortune, I mean, I can't even believe it, to interview throughout my career. You will meet many of them on this season of the Grapes, Grains, and Grub audio show, and you really can get to know them even better on our website, where you will find behind-the-scenes pictures and more. Our social media accounts are at Grapes, Grains, Grub. Our hashtag is agriculture tastes good. And do please sign up for our newsletter because it's not your normal newsletter. We really do have some truly different offers and experiences. Until we meet again on your favorite audio platform, please make an effort to buy your food as close to the source as possible and start a conversation with the butcher and veggie department people at your local market. I'm so grateful for you listening, so we keep bringing you these candid conversations with these really dedicated people who fill our plates, bellies, and souls. I'm Cecily Armstrong, and I'm having grilled asparagus, stuffed jalapenos, smoked oysters, and a delicious tempranillo from the Newsome Vineyards for dinner. What are you having? Let me know before our next week's episode. Adios.
The Grapes, Grains, and Grub Show is produced by Nitex Productions, a Nitex Studios Originals. The executive producer is Cecily Armstrong, producer is Stephanie Locke. Associate producer is Pauline Moore with assistance from the team at Nitex Studios. Theme music and original composition by Frank Castro. Hey, that's me. Yeehaw!